Our hypothesis is that our internal controls are very, very good. But the effort to go from 99% to 100% in terms of control effectiveness is infinite. You can make a lot of effort, spend a lot of time, effort, and energy, and still not get from 99% to 100%. A more efficient process is to get a sieve at the back end of the process and to be able to capture whatever little leakage we may have had, and to be able to quantify, you know, what the extent of that leakage is, which is likely to be very small in terms of percentage, but fairly decent in terms of dollars.
Welcome to the Ultimate Supplier Management Podcast from Apex Analytics. This is an audio version of a recent webinar we had with the Hershey Company. Sanjay Singh, VP of Internal Audit, and Jonathan Lobenstein, Senior Director of Internal Audit, discussed why they wanted to have an AP recovery audit and how they sold it internally. Phil Bean from Apex joined them during this presentation. Since it was a webinar, there are slides you can download in the episode notes. With that, enjoy the show.
This is Sanjay from Hershey. So just to give you a little bit of background about the Hershey Company, we are $8.9 billion in net sales. And we've been around for, you know, over 100 years. And I'm sure you've all tried a Hershey chocolate bar. But our confection story is very well documented and very well known. What is relatively unknown is our presence in U.S. snacking. So for a lot of us, it may be a source of surprise that we are the number two snacking company in the U.S. So if you look at the brands like Skinny Pops, Pocky, One Bars, they are all brands from our subsidiaries, One Brands, Amplify. We just acquired Dots and Pretzels. So that's the emerging story at Hershey and a big part of our growth plans. We have 17,000 employees globally. About 90% of our business is U.S.-based. So we have a relatively small footprint compared to a lot of the other confection companies. And the last 3 years have been absolutely phenomenal. The 25% annualized three-year shareholder returns is definitely the top quartile among CPG companies. A part of that growth has just been fantastic execution on our part relative to some of the competition. And the other part of that equation is just COVID and people not being able to step out of the house or take a vacation or go to the movies. And the least thing they could do is, you know, buy their kids a little bit of a comfort food. So that resulted in an increase in some chocolate sales. And obviously, given the fact that we are global, including manufacturing facilities abroad, the biggest one being in Malaysia, we have a relatively global supply chain, and our biggest raw material, which is cocoa, obviously comes from Africa. So this slide, I think, is probably the most pertinent slide from my vantage point. So it captures the essence of how we went about the process of doing the recovery audits. So obviously, we initiated action. Then we gained internal traction. That was a little bit of a process. Then there's the whole question around managing the project end-to-end, including the external auditor who did the work for us, and then setting up a cyclical process where this could be repeated. If I were to add something in the slide, I'd say there's a process 3A, which is implementing process improvements before we start repeating the cycle to make sure that we can tweak our internal controls where they need to be so the process is better the next time around. So the point I would want to emphasize on this slide is there's three underlying questions, because in the process of initiating action and gaining internal traction, if this process is not managed well internally, the entire process could go sideways. So the three key questions in my head were, A, who looks bad? B, who gets the credit for this effort? And C, who gets the recovery dollars? And we went about this process fairly meticulously and with, you know, some element of wisdom, because one way to articulate this entire process is to say our controls are suboptimal and we need to get somebody from the outside to figure out what the leakage is, which clearly in our mind was not the right way to go about it. The way we wanted to articulate the message was to say, look, internal controls. Our hypothesis is that our internal controls are very, very good. But the effort to go from 99% to 100% in terms of control effectiveness is infinite. You could make a lot of effort, spend a lot of time, effort, and energy, and still not get from 99 to 100%. A more efficient process is to get a sieve at the back end of the process and to be able to capture whatever little leakage we may have had and to be able to quantify, you know, what the extent of that leakage is, which is likely to be very small in terms of percentage, but fairly decent in terms of dollars. So that was the question on how to go about marketing this concept internally without making anybody look bad. The second question is, who gets the credit for it? Do we go around the organization saying, hey, this is an idea, internal audit came around, and therefore we get to get the credit, pat on our back, and shame to everybody else, including shared services and global business services, because they never thought about it. That clearly was not the way we went about it. It was a very collaborative effort between internal audit and the vice president of global business services. And that's the way we marketed it to the entire finance function and to the organization as a whole, saying, look, you know, here is a hypothesis. Internal audit can facilitate the process because we are audit and control experts internally. And, you know, the heavy lifting on the business side will be done by global business services, who are more than an equal partner in the process. And then the third question was, who gets the recovery dollars? And my answer is, I don't care. I mean, we recover a million or two or five. All the people who need to know that the money was recovered will know. And, you know, it's probably not appropriate for internal audit to go, you know, talking about how we recovered the money, which was leaked out of the global business services or the shared services organization. So I think those three questions were really, really critical in terms of us being able to make headway and be able to sell and market this in a, you know, collegial and collaborative way, as opposed to getting into a confrontational relationship with global services. So the question is, why is internal audit the driving force? So the answer to that question is, it just so happened that at Hershey, the circumstances were right for internal audit to be a driving force for this process. I was the one who had prior experience with recovery audits. We had a fair number of projects at Starbucks, and we had, you know, recoveries in multiple millions of dollars. So I had the belief and I had the conviction to go around selling the concept to people and saying, look, you know, I think there's dollars to be had here and we should go around it. So my prior experience, plus secondarily, in line with internal audit's digital audit strategy, we are moving into adjacent categories of services compared to what we had done in the past. And this recovery audit using technology and using an outside resource was definitely an adjacent category we could move into, and the organization didn't have any resources dedicated to the effort at all. So that is the reason why we internal audit spearheaded the process at Hershey. But broadly speaking, there is no reason that internal audit needs to spearhead the process. You could, you know, easily have shared services or global business services spearhead the effort. You may want to solicit the support of internal audit if there's additional controls you could put in place to make sure the process becomes more sustainable over some time. Internal audit tends to be the resident expert on controls and risks in most organizations. So a collaborative effort with them may be helpful. But there's no reason why they should be actually driving it. The circumstances at Hershey made it so that we drove the process, but that's not a mandate. That was definitely a choice.
Yeah, Sanjay, just very strategic thought process and initiatives around that. And you made a comment earlier, I think it's worth repeating, which, you know, even with the strongest controls, which you all have very strong controls there at Hershey, there's still going to be a small percentage of opportunity, i.e. errors that are recovered through a recovery audit. So thanks for that. And Jonathan, I'll turn it over to you now and let you walk us through the details. I know Sanjay covered kind of high level, but the details around the actual approach that Hershey took towards engaging a recovery audit service.
Okay, great. Thank you, Phil. So yeah, as Sanjay had mentioned, yeah, really kind of four key steps in terms of, you know, the recovery audit process. So, you know, the first one there, initiating action. So all projects, in order to be successful, somebody has to go out and initiate the action. In this case, you know, that was our team from internal audit. And, you know, obviously Sanjay had the prior experience, you know, knew that recovery audits were, you know, kind of low risk endeavor, but really a win-win for, you know, the audit team, the business team, and even the recovery auditor. So, you know, really to kind of be able to propose this internally, you know, had a lot of discussions with our peers and with, you know, Apex and other experts in the industry, making sure we understand, hey, what are the benefits of this current approach? What results may we be able to expect? And then also what type of return on investment we may get from a company standpoint, whether that be dollars returned or, you know, also an enhancement from a control environment perspective. So that was really, you know, the first step around initiating action.
Yeah, and the fact that this project was initiated through internal audit versus maybe the more traditional way, which is it goes straight into AP. Sanjay touched on this, but really you all had to do some selling internally to kind of get the buy-in. So maybe share a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, that's a good segue if we jump over to the next slide here, you know, kind of second step in the process, gaining internal traction. So, you know, really kind of two key stakeholders, if you will, to gain traction with. And I think, you know, the different groups probably have a little bit of a different focus area. So one, obviously, top-down support from senior leadership. And then second, gaining internal traction with the individuals who on a daily basis are responsible for accounts payable and purchasing. So that's really the area that we're doing the recovery audit in. So, you know, really to kind of prepare for this, obviously, you know, did some research and analytics internally looking at how do we quantify the level of spend we have at Hershey? Where is that money being spent? How do we kind of categorize that, mixing in kind of prior experience Sanjay had had, and then, you know, the experience from Apex as well, you know, based on spending we have and where we're spending and where they've seen recoveries in the past. And then that really helped us be able to quantify the impact to say, hey, what could the benefit be? So I would say that was really the preparation and the internal traction from a senior leadership standpoint. And then, you know, if we kind of shift more so to, you know, the folks that are responsible for managing procurement and payments on an ongoing basis, you know, there we wanted to be very clear in terms of the basics. So what a recovery audit is, what level of effort would be required on their part, setting the right context in terms of, okay, you know, if recoveries are found, you know, why, obviously it's a benefit to the company, but why it's not necessarily a negative reflection on the accounts payable team. So I think, you know, kind of doing that, we were able to get that alignment. I think we all saw it as, you know, a positive exercise to undertake. And then also just handling a lot of things up front in the beginning in terms of, you know, lining up where recoveries would be booked. Obviously, you know, we were open to wherever that should be. But, you know, just kind of lining those things up so everybody had full visibility and our eyes were kind of wide open in terms of what we were getting into.
Yeah, and I'll just say, as your partner, Jonathan, we really appreciated the planning up front. And you mentioned this earlier, but I think it's just worth repeating. You know, the recovery audit is really a low-risk exercise. It could be a very high reward, but certainly low risk for those that have been involved in recovery audit. You know this. Those that haven't, it's an important piece. But when we perform a recovery audit, we're identifying where there may be monies to recover. We're recovering those. We're providing them back to you with recommendations on how you fix them. Once you receive the economic value, then Apex is paid a small percentage of those recoveries. And so, you know, I touched on this a little bit earlier with Sanjay, but 99.99, keep going with the nines percent of the time, Hershey and other clients that we serve, the process works. There aren't duplicate payments. There aren't outstanding credits. It's really that small fraction, that less than 1%. That's where we operate. And that's why I think, you know, when I say it's low risk aspect, we're experts. That's what we do day in and day out. We operate in that less than 1% with the goal being just to, hey, at the end of the day, we want to validate that the hard work that Hershey and other organizations have put in place from process procedure, it's working. And in the event that there are some small opportunities to improve processes, we want to identify those, get them over to Hershey and our other clients so that you guys can put the changes in place, which is what Sanjay talked about earlier. So anyway, that's just, you know, big picture. It's a very low risk. Certainly, you know, we operate in that less than 1% space. Generally, we do find something. It varies what we find. Maybe there's some duplicate payments or returns or rebates or credits. you know, canceled contract service, various types of things that we find.
Absolutely, Phil. So really, you know, kind of jumping into the third phase, if you will, of the project. So we talked about, you know, initiating action, then gaining our internal traction. And then it really, you know, comes down to how do you effectively manage the recovery audit project itself? So looking at that, some things that we lined up front with Apex, as well as our shared services team, you know, really making sure we have clarity over what constitutes an actual recovery and what does not, right? Because management has some processes in place already, right? We talked about, you know, the solid control environment that we have. You know, they have internal review processes and things that they're validating around duplicate payments. So just being really clear with that up front, you know, internally and with your partner so that everybody's aligned. It helps in two ways. You know, there's no back and forth later on, but I would say, you know, more importantly, it helps your recovery auditor to focus on areas of potential risk that may drive value, you know, for your company versus, you know, going back and looking at potential things that you may have already identified. And then I think, you know, really the second thing would be, you know, kind of enabling and empowering resources, you know, internally at your company to directly support the project. So obviously, internal audit initiated the project and we helped manage the project, but getting our accounts payable or procurement, you know, resources that we have, feeling, you know, kind of the ownership, if you will, in terms of some of the tactical execution, you know, direct contact with the recovery auditors, and then, you know, to the extent necessary, direct contact with any of the third parties that we do business with that they may need to, you know, follow up with in terms of requests. So I think setting it up in that type of structure, I think it made it smooth as possible, you know, for Apex as well as internally and with our third party partners. And I think as well, not just clarity over what constitutes a recovery, but, you know, just lining up internally very early on to say, here's the fee and billing protocols, right? We're going into this. Obviously, there has to be benefit on both sides, you know, the recovery auditor and the client that they have. And then to really kind of the last thing in terms of managing the project, you know, obviously, we went and sold the benefits to everybody within our shared service organization, but also to senior leadership. So obviously, they had an expectation of being aware of how the audit was going, what the successes were, what type of recoveries. And what we did there was to really set up a structured cadence and make sure to share those results out on a frequent basis and provide credit where it was deserved with the right folks within the organization.
You know, for me, when I to hear you talk about that, what I think about is transparency. And really, that's what allows the partnership that we have today. And so, you know, our goal is just go in, validate the processes you have in place where there may be some opportunities to improve, identify those, recover any funds, provide those back to you with explanations why we found it, how we found it, how you might fix it. So, you know, big picture, that's it. And also, you know, as you talk about kind of the repeating the cycle, which is a big piece of this slide, I think it's important to mention that it's really looking at kind of this continuous audit and is there value associated with that versus the more traditional, you know, start an audit and then finish an audit. So anyway, just an additional point. We can talk more about that later.
Excellent. So if we jump to the next slide, that's another good segue, you know, in terms of repeating the cycle. So obviously, we just had this recovery audit performed and kind of concluded the last cycle. I think we got some good recoveries. And obviously, we found, you know, some areas where we may want to tweak some processes internally. So we've really kind of set up the timeline that we're using to be able to implement the process enhancements that we're looking to do, and then really looking to set up to repeat the cycle. So really, I think Sanjay hit on this earlier, but if your goal isn't to just, you know, implement controls at any cost, really the recoveries of this type of audit really can be ongoing and eternal. And if controls are so robust that the recoveries are, you know, no longer worth the audit effort of the recovery auditor, obviously then they would have little interest in, you know, continuing the effort. So that would really kind of bring things to an organic close. But, you know, we're looking at it and saying we've got good value. We have some control enhancements that we're implementing, but it's something that we're certainly looking to continue on into the future.
Yeah, and I know Sanjay talked about this, but, you know, really important for you all as opportunities for improvements are identified that you put those in place and so that you can go back and evaluate, did it work? You know, right, we identified that there was maybe a process gap here. you all have worked with maybe AP and actually improved the process, and then you go back and validate. And I touched on a little bit of that just on the prior slide around that continuous audit, being able to give you that feedback on a more regular basis versus the more traditional way, which is, you know, start an audit, go through the cycle, finish it. The results that you're getting have some age to them because you're not getting it more real time versus doing this on a more continual basis. A lot of our clients are really appreciating that now so that they can get the feedback and we can explain to them, hey, you have an issue around rebates and we've seen it over the last 120 days versus in 2020, late 2020 and early 2021, maybe you had a returns issue and you're not really sure, well, does that still exist? Have we corrected that? So anyway, just some additional information around that reoccurring audit and how for some clients that can provide value, especially when there's changes within the organization.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So, you know, if I look at the process and repeating the cycle, a few different ways to look at it, right? Obviously, there's some effort in doing a recovery audit and you have to look to say, what is the proper timing? So we're in the middle of a major S4 HANA implementation currently. And, you know, initially was kind of looking at it and saying, wow, there's a lot going on. Is this a good time, you know, to continue and repeat the cycle? And I think, you know, Phil can share a little bit here, but obviously looking at it, we're saying, yes, there's a lot going on, but whenever you have some type of a major process change or a major systems change, there's a lot of change management and there's a learning curve that goes along with that. And, you know, actually, it's a really good time to continue and make sure that you have, you know, solid controls in place over your payments.
Yeah, which is a great introduction to just a case study that I'll share with you. And by the way, this is not Hershey. This is another client that we work with. This specific client, not only do we do recovery audit services, but they also have our First Strike technology, which they use to prevent duplicates. And so, Jonathan, you talked about the S4HANA migration that you're going to be going through. This specific case study for this client, they were actually moving from an on-prem ERP. Wasn't S4HANA, so I'll let you guess what it was. They were moving from an on-prem solution to this ERP's cloud solution. Massive change. Obviously, you all are going to be going through that with the S4HANA, but massive change, lots of planning associated with that. And what this graph is showing is that prior to, you know, July, when they actually did the cutover, they had, it's just basically showing the duplicates that they prevented on a monthly basis. In July of this year, of last year, was the actual cutover, moving from on-prem to this cloud-based solution. And you can see the number of duplicate payments that they prevented really during that four-month period increased over 1,600%. So the point isn't to, hey, to scare you away from change. I mean, change is a good thing, especially in the example I'm going through and for Hershey. But it's just you need to be aware that there's risk. You know, I tell people all the time, if there's change in your business, there's risk for overpayments. So if you're going to be going through some sort of major change, whether it be ERP upgrade or outsourcing, just have some processes and controls in place. This client has our First Strike due prevention technology, recovery audit. Recovery audit's great. It is a little bit in arrears. And so having something that can be a little more proactive that can identify those before they're going out the door. So next slide is not a case study, but it's actually a benchmarking report that we're just wrapping up on. And what we've done is we've looked at roughly 4 years worth of data, some from our recovery audits. Spend was just over $6 trillion for this four-year period of time. And something that we've always thought is, boy, when there is a delay in a recovery audit, like what does that mean? If I do a recovery audit every year and then I take a year off, you know, our theory was, boy, there are potential recoveries that erode, that actually go away. But it was just our thought. And so as part of this benchmarking report, we basically took the data, aligned the data, went through some analysis. And what the data is telling us is that for every year that a company decides to take a break from a recovery audit, roughly 23% of the potential recoveries erode. And so what that boils down to is like, okay, well, why does that occur? And there's a few reasons that the data showed us. The first is, and this was, we saw this increase materially over COVID, but suppliers going out of business. So if you're doing business with a supplier, you make a duplicate payment or there's an outstanding credit, the supplier goes out of business, those potential recoveries are gone. You stop doing business with a supplier. Again, COVID impacted that supply chain, changing who you do business with. And so you lose a lot of leverage when you're no longer doing business with a supplier. And then the last piece was just misapplication, or maybe there be a credit or a duplicate and it sits there for a long period of time and it just gets moved into a general fund. It gets misapplied, maybe to some outstanding invoices. Maybe it gets moved to profit. So big picture, what we were looking for was, hey, we know it happens. We just don't know what the percentage is. But what is the cost of waiting a year to perform a recovery audit? And basically what the data says is it's roughly 23% erosion on an annual basis. Sanjay, I'll turn it back over to you.
So we had give or take about $1 million in recoveries. So let me just use this slide to highlight very quickly and very succinctly the advantages of going through this process. A, it's a free audit. We had to, you know, pay nothing if we recovered nothing. And anything which is free, I'll take, you know, every day of the week. The second is it gives us an opportunity to assess our internal controls. Obviously, there's internal mechanisms to assess internal controls, but we are looking at this from an entirely different lens and reassessing our internal controls from the leakage perspective. The third is it gives us benchmarks relative to our peer groups, right? I mean, when we do internal controls assessment internally, we say, hey, yeah, controls are working 98% or 99%. We have no idea how that stacks up to the rest of the world. So benchmarking with peers' data is really helpful. The ROI on these projects is infinite. Literally, it's infinite. If I find nothing, I pay nothing, which means I make zero investment up front and whatever I get is money in the bank. And then finally, it's very little internal resource investment relative to the cumulative, quantifiable, and qualitative benefits that we get.
So I want to wrap us up with another significant opportunity where there's potential for massive recoveries. And so what we've talked about thus far in Hershey's journey was around an accounts payable audit. Now I want to talk about a service that we've delivered for years, but over the last, I'd say 16, 18 months, there's been a material uptick in clients requesting us to serve them, and that is contract compliance. So contract compliance, unlike AP, is a service that we provide, but it is really looking at a specific relationship, contractual relationship, that our clients have with a given supplier. And so it's essentially us looking at the T's and C's of the contract and at a macro level saying, okay, what was negotiated generally by your procurement organization with a given supplier over a specific period of time? Did it actually occur? And so the reason that my opinion on the reason that we've seen this material uptick is based on COVID and, you know, for obvious reasons, supply chain disruptions. That's a big one. There's been just kind of this high demand of COVID-19 products. There's been a change in workforce. And so there's been many companies, most companies that moved in 2020 from a traditional in-office to a remote work site. And so, you know, facilities that typically had lots of people and used lots of services, now they've all changed. So there's been this major shift, this big change that happened in 2020. And on the backside of 2020, beginning of 2021, that's where we saw this influx of requests around contract compliance. You can see on the slide, the types of recoveries that we find are generally exponentially larger than what we would find for an AP. And the reason is just the sheer volume. And so, you know, the types of things, and it'll make more sense when I talk about this, the types of things that we find, incorrect classification or markup as it pertains to quantities or tier pricing breaks, volume discounts, that's another big one where we find a lot of recoveries, canceled contracts and services, huge over the last year. And that's an immediate impact of COVID is that, hey, we had this service for X, Y, and Z, we're no longer using it yet, they're still sending us invoices and we're paying cost plus contracts. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, just depending on the supplier and the industry they're in. But I thought it was worth mentioning at the end of the presentation, just because of the uptick in requests that we've had from our clients. So a lot of clients actually do this internally. I might just encourage, if you're not doing it internally, that it's something that you look to adding, as Sanjay and Jonathan talked about, kind of to your internal process as an extension of what you're doing today. It does require some collaboration. So it's, you know, procurement's usually involved, AP's usually involved. Your suppliers are also heavily involved. So if it's not something that you're doing today, I just encourage you to look into it and see if it could provide value back to your organization. And like Sanjay talked about earlier, it's low risk. It's all based on contingent. So if there are no opportunities, there's no cost associated with it.
And that will bring us to the Q&A portion of our webinar. But before we do that, I want to draw your attention to a poll question, which is about to be displayed on your screen. We want to know what information that you would be interested in receiving from Apex Analytics based on everything that you have heard today. While you all answer that question, I invite you to submit your questions for Phil, Sanjay, and Jonathan. Go ahead, use the chat tool on your screen to enter your questions and to submit them to me. We'll answer as many questions as time allows. And gentlemen, as you may have imagined, we have lots of questions from attendees. So let's get right to them. Sanjay, our first question from an attendee, they want to know, does a recovery audit span both AR as well as AP?
So technically, there is literally no boundaries on what you can do in terms of recovery audits. So the way we look at the landscape is, yes, you can do it on the AR side and you can do it on the AP side. You have to be a lot more cautious and work collaboratively with people in marketing and sales on the AR side because they could impact some of your valuable customer relationships, right? To go back to a customer and say, hey, here's money you owe me from 3 years ago is a little different from going to a supplier and saying, hey, you owe me money from 2 or 3 years ago. So I think it's just a lot more sensitive. What we did is we said we are going to divide up the landscape and do it in various different buckets. So some of them are general AP buckets, which we did via this exercise. And then we got some input from Apex and other people on, hey, what are the other specialized areas where we could go in and do work, which is beyond the scope of a general AP audit? So if you break down that subset, we have this year, we are looking at telecommunications as a standalone subject. We're looking at advertising as a standalone subject because that area is complicated and continues to get more complicated with the advent of digital technology. And we're going to look at contract compliance. So we're going to look at some other buckets under AP. But yes, you could definitely look at AR. Just would urge you to exercise a lot of caution.
Phil, do you agree with all that?
I do. And most of what we do is specific to AP. We don't generally do a lot of recovery audits on the AR side for the reasons that Sanjay mentioned.
Jonathan, next question for you. One of our attendees wants to know, so why did Hershey's decide to change its recovery audit method?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think as we kind of looked at it in the past, a number of years ago, we had more of a formal recovery audit program. And I think, you know, like all things over time, things continue to evolve. And we kind of looked at it and said, who's the right partner to help us out on this endeavor? What's the right timing? And, you know, I think everything kind of lined up. So it's not that we had never had a recovery audit program. We you know, simply just hadn't for a number of years.
Phil, it seems like everything is changing these days. Are you seeing more organizations rethinking the way that they go about recovery audits?
I would say years ago, there were more organizations that were trying to perform this internally. And we've seen it, or I can say just based on my experience, I've seen a shift where, especially AP, they're more focused on their core competency versus trying to dabble in the recovery audit space and actually leaving that for firms like Apex, but adding them on as an extension to what they do versus, hey, this is a service that we go procure. This is an extension to what we do internally. And when that exists, and that's why we're having this webinar with Hershey, that's what creates that partnership. It's actually an extension. And so we're collaborating and there's transparency versus it's just a commodity. It's a service that we're procuring.
Sanjay, one of our attendees writes, talk more to us about the resources required for the project, the time commitment on their part, and how you managed all these moving parts.
I'm going to punt on this question. I think Jonathan was closer and providing more tactical leadership on this. So Jonathan's probably better equipped to answer that question in a lot more detail. But I will summarize that the resources needed for this endeavor were legal, to start with because they wrote up the contract. There was Global Business Services, which did a lot of the heavy lifting because, I mean, they know the business process much better than Internal Audit does. Internal Audit, we provided the internal selling of the proposition and we facilitated the entire process. So we were kind of the glue which brought it all together. In terms of specific hours and whatnot, I'll let John answer that question.
Yeah, thanks, Sanjay. So, you know, I don't have the specific hours, but what I will tell you is if we look at it, you know, the number of resources required to oversee and execute from an internal standpoint, I would say are actually, you know, very low in comparison to the recoveries that we got. So there's, you know, one individual on my team who kind of ran point in terms of managing the project, managing communications with our shared services team. And then I would say there were two or three people in accounts payable who were in more direct contact with Apex throughout the process. But this was not a scenario of, you know, drop everything else we're doing and just focus on supporting Apex for a recovery audit. I think it was, you know, really, really a seamless activity, which is why, you know, future. So I would say, you know, it's not super resource intensive. And I think the reason for that is we got good internal alignment initially, and then everybody had transparency in terms of how the process would work.
I think it does well. And Phil, if I'm reading between the lines of this question, I reckon this person's thinking to themselves, my gosh, we have enough on our plates at AP right now. How in the devil are we going to take this on? This is a question I suspect you get a lot. Talk to us about that. I mean, Hershey's, it didn't sound like it was too onerous. Is that the rule?
It is. And the key, and Jonathan and Sanjay talked about this, is it's the planning up front. You are partnering with Apex to perform this work. This is all we do. You know, so we're not processing invoices and ensuring payments are made on time. We are just performing recovery audits. So you have a team that's assigned to your engagement, the planning that we put in place before the audit begins. We establish project plans. If there's some big initiative that you're going to have ongoing or that's going to start, we plan around that such that when it's time to execute, the onus is on Apex, right? We ensure that we align on the process, what an actual recovery means, the time frame that we're going to pursue, the method in which we're going to recover the funds, i.e. a credit memo or in the U.S. a check or maybe a wire. So all that planning up front to ensure that once we start the execution, it's a very smooth process. With, you know, our goal is minimal interaction from our client.
Jonathan, a related question, I suspect, and this person wants to know, talk more about how you communicated with AP throughout the process of the project.
Yeah, so we had a lot of communication with AP, but we tried to do it in a structured cadence. So we set up, you know, periodic touch points with a small group of individuals, those that were, you know, most directly involved and impacted, to make sure we were clear on, you know, the status of potential recoveries, any additional information that would be required from our suppliers, and also, you know, shared out the status, actual recoveries that we've received. And I think that doing that on an ongoing basis really helped to build momentum and support for the program. It wasn't, hey, we'll be back in a year and let you know what we found. If, you know, every few weeks or every month, we were sharing out the results, and I think it built a lot of positive traction.
Phil, give us some best practices for communicating with AP. The things that Jonathan did sound like a good start. What else would you recommend?
This was touched on early in the presentation, but you know what you don't want to do is you don't want to pass blame. So this is not an initiative to say, boy, Phil's not doing a good job in AP. You know, the reality is, and I talked about this, 99.99, you know, keep with the nines, it's done accurately. I mean, this is really just an extension of the work that we're doing. It's also fair to say you're not going to be perfect. Just based on the sheer volume, it's impossible to be perfect. You know, our job is to confirm the processes that you have in place that are strong and identify areas where you can improve. And so if you go into this open-minded from an evaluation standpoint, from an AP standpoint, and don't look at it as, boy, you're here to make me look bad. No, I'm here to partner with you to share the positives that you have in place and also identify where you can improve. So I think that's just a key piece up front. And it's not just with AP. I mean, internal audit ran this at Hershey and evangelized it. But if you go through a traditional AP, it's to share that message maybe up through the P2P organization, maybe to a controller, that this is a positive thing. You know, we're going to identify if there's recoveries out there to be had, but we're also doing it to improve our internal processes. And again, it's a continuation of what we have in place today.
Jonathan, another attendee wants to know, what's the success rate of recovering money from government entities?
That is a really good question. I would have to defer that one to Phil.
All right, Phil. So will governments pay up?
Yeah, so well, that's an interesting one. And I'll have
Wouldn't
to
you love to know the backstory on this one?
Now, I'll be careful to protect the innocent here. So we have in the past performed some services for some government entities, and I will just leave it at that. There was ample opportunities to be had. The challenge was that what we ran into was the willingness of the government to actually go get the money back. So that's at a macro level, partnering with maybe a government entity to do a recovery audit. Another piece of maybe the question was, what is the success rate of us reaching out to maybe state jurisdictions, governments? It's 50-50. And some of our clients do not want us to include that, and they're excluded from the audit. As a general rule, we say, hey, outside of maybe board of directors or charitable organizations or suppliers that you might be in litigation, you really shouldn't exclude anything. You should really want to know what's out there. But there are clients that say, look, exclude the government entities because, you know, sometimes that's passed through those costs associated with that. So I'm rambling a little bit, Mark, being a little bit vague, but it just really depends. But it is more challenging than a typical supplier.
Easier question, no doubt, for all of you. Sanjay, one of our attendees wants to know, what is one change that came from the audit that is part of your processes now?
So, can I just talk about two changes? So one change was we looked at some internal processes and said, oh, let's fix these internally because we can make minor tweaks. And the next time we do this audit, there's going to be, you know, less recovery. So we can easily plug this without creating much more of a process bottleneck or effort internally. The other change is after we found initial success, the resistance to using this protocol in other spaces. So we're doing advertising now. We're having a conversation with the advertising folks. So after you told them, like, hey, you did this and we found $1 million somewhere, the resistance and the guard is not up as much with other people, especially if you tell them, we'll find the money, but it's your money to keep. We don't want to keep the money. So I think one change is more cultural and in terms of acceptance for future recovery audits. The other change is much more tactical, and it's about process improvement.
Phil, what's the most common change organizations make as a result of doing an audit recovery?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say most of what we find is not systemic, especially in AP. And so a lot of times, actually, a heavy portion of what we identify really isn't even an AP function. And so obviously things like duplicate payments, they're generally associated with AP. But, you know, when you have a returns issue or you have a rebate issue, I mean, it's AP themselves can't always fix that. And so, you know, back to the question, I'd say the biggest change and generally the quickest change that can be implemented, and it's associated with many of the root causes that we identify, is training. And especially with COVID, because there was this massive disruption, folks who typically collaborated face-to-face are now all working remote. Now, I know some of that change is occurring where folks are going back, but it's just training. So it's ensuring that people understand, I'll use returns as an example, like what is the return process? What exactly do I need to do when I return something? The rebate process, when the rebate is negotiated, you know, who is responsible for tracking that? Is it entered into AP? How do we ensure that when we hit that threshold? So there are some systemic things, right? So I'm not saying we don't find those, but a lot of times it's because we operate in that less than 1%. It's just some training. It's tweaking the process, ensuring that everyone's aligned on what needs to happen.
Phil, one of our attendees asks, is there diminishing returns for continued recovery audits?
Yes. So, well, yes, as long as there's no change within your organization. So if you have a very stable organization, not making a lot of system changes, not much M&A, you're not doing much outsourcing, onshoring, offshoring. If it's just pretty stable and we're doing either continuous audit or doing annual audits, we should see a natural decline. I would say most of the clients that we serve, I wouldn't classify as sitting idle. And just like, you know, Sanjay and Jonathan has talked about, I mean, there's change within the organization. They're doing their S/4HANA. And so when there is change, it's like, for those that know what whack-a-mole is, it's that analogy is you get it under control and then change occurs and something new pops up. So if you're very stable, absolutely diminishing return. If there's change in your organization, you're going to constantly have opportunities to identify control weaknesses and recover funds.
Phil, if there's one thing I've learned being in the AP industry all these years, it's that AP managers know how to play whack-a-mole. Sanjay, one of our attendees wants to know, what was the biggest objection you got to this project? From who did it come and how did you overcome it?
So we didn't necessarily have big objections because we preempted those big objections because of my prior experience, because two of the biggest objections you get in a company is, look, our internal controls are pretty good. This is going to make us look bad. And then the second one is, we're going to get all these recoveries. Who is it going to go to and who's going to get credit and who's going to look glorious? So we anticipated those questions, preempted that, but those questions were very relevant when I did my first dance at Starbucks with exactly the same landscape.
Yeah. Who looked more glorious, you or John? No, don't answer that. I'm only kidding. Hey, Phil, another attendee writes, recoveries become income. So how do companies react to the tax implications to these recoveries?
Yeah, it really depends on the year in which the recovery is associated with. And so, you know, it just depends if, and that goes back some to if we're doing a continuous audit, meaning we're auditing on a more frequent basis versus the starting and stopping. You know, I'll say that, and I know Sanjay and Jonathan touched on this, but where the recoveries go, a lot of our clients will implement the recovery is in the current fiscal year, that it will go back to the business. And so it just goes back to the business and is handled in that year's normal financial and tax implications. If it's in a prior year and the books are closed, it will be kept within the organization that's conducting the recovery audit. And I'm not prescribing this. I'm just saying this is a scenario that we see often. And the reason behind that is, well, the books are already closed for, we'll just say, you know, fiscal year 2021. And so the actual recoveries could be used for strategic initiatives. Certainly from a tax implication, will be slightly different versus if it's in the current fiscal year.
Jonathan, single biggest piece of advice you'd leave our attendees with today?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I would leave in terms of advice is, you know, if you haven't done recovery audits before, it's something certainly, we've seen benefit in. I know Sanjay has seen it a lot of other companies. It's easy to look and say, wow, we're too busy. We have all these other projects ongoing. But I would say, especially if you look at it from an audit standpoint, typically we're more of a cost center, right? You're not generally generating dollars for the organization, and it's hard to quantify savings on proactive risk management, right? So I would say if, this is something you're not doing today, it's something I would certainly consider where the value could be.
Sanjay, same question to you. Give me a different answer, though.
Just to manage the process internally, culturally well, because there's the entire technical piece of it and the quantitative piece of it. But if you don't handle it right culturally on the inside, the project's not going to get traction and it's going to get a lot of resistance.
And that will be our final word. Phil, Sanjay, Jonathan, thank you so much for an excellent presentation and for sharing your insights with us today. And thank you all for taking time out of your busy days to join us.